political seat on her own early in her life. When she met Clinton at Yale, he seemed a perfect fit. He was gregarious, smart, and charismatic, but not particularly deep. A sponge for detail, Clinton lacked a consistent ideology upon which to hang his facts. This was the yin to Hillary Rodham's yang, the driven ideologue Hillary ran her husband's campaigns, directed and organized the staff, and controlled his appearances. Since her political future was entirely in his hands, she willingly assumed the role of governor's wife after Clinton won his first election. When Clinton gained the presidency in 1992, Hillary was fully in her element. Clearly, an understanding had been struck long before the election. Hillary Clinton would play the loyal wife in order to gain power, and once in office, Bill would reward her through policy appointments that did not require Senate confirmation. Consummating the deal, the president immediately named Hillary to head a task force to review and fix the nation's health care crisis. The only real crisis was the lack of congressional will to cut costs or raise revenue for the costly and inefficient Medicare and Medicaid programs. Instead, Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Committee diverted the debate to one of uninsurability, implying that any Americans who lacked insurance had no access to medical treatment. In fact, it meant nothing of the sort. Millions of Americans in sole proprietorships or other small businesses found it cheaper to pay cash for medical care, and there was always emergency medical care available to anyone, insured or not. Mrs. Clinton had her opening to policy direction. Meeting with dozens of Democratic allies and experts in secret sessions in clear violation of federal sunshine laws, as a subsequent court ruling later made plain, Hillary, with the help of Ira Magaziner, finally unveiled a health care plan so massive in scope that even other advisors were aghast. It was a political blunder of enormous magnitude. One of the administration's own economists had argued that one of the first messages from the new Democratic administration should not be to put one-seventh of the American economy under the command and control of the federal government. The plan dictated, among other things, the specialties medical students should pursue, where doctors could practice, and which physicians individual Americans would be allowed to see. More stunning, the proposal threatened to punish by fines and jail doctors who accepted cash for providing a service and patients who paid cash for health care. In addition, employer mandates for even the smallest of businesses to insure employees would have been the death knell of millions of small businesses. When word of Hillary Care started to leak out, it produced a firestorm of opposition. Radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh, who had a national weekly audience of nearly 20 million, led the assault by reading on-air critiques of the health care plan by Democratic consumer writer Elizabeth McCoy. Needless to say, few legislators, and even fewer average citizens, had read the massive 1,342-page document. But McCoy had, and Limbaugh exposed the details on a daily basis. Legislators of both parties ran for the hills away from Hillary Care, and it went down to ignominious defeat when the majority Democrats in the House refused to bring it up for a vote. Arguably, it was the first time in history that a single radio or television personality had exercised so much influence in defeating unpopular legislation. In no way was the bill the victim of intense partisan wrangling, or the determination of Republican leaders to deny the president any kind of victory on this potent issue, as liberal historians argued. It died because the public learned its details and refused to support it. Clinton's budget measures did not fare well either. The first Clinton budget, a deficit reduction plan, hiked taxes, including a Social Security tax on the elderly, and required a tie-breaking vote from his vice president. Early on, Clinton's war room of strategists had convinced him that he had to attack the deficits and that such action would give him credibility in other, more liberal initiatives. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen impressed in unusually blunt language the significance of soothing Wall Street with his budget. "You mean to tell me," Clinton asked his advisers, "that the success of the program and my re-election hinges on a bunch of fucking bond traders?" Nods from around the table greeted him. Under a program called the Reinvention of Government, ostensibly to reduce government size and waste, Clinton slashed 286,000 jobs from the Department of Defense and only 19,000 from non-defense agencies. It marked the beginning of a simultaneous slashing of military capability on the one hand and unparalleled military commitments abroad on the other. Within 3 years, Clinton had increased overseas deployments and, at the same time, reduced the total active duty force from 2.1 million to 1.6 million, reduced the Army from 18 full-strength divisions to 12. The Gulf War alone had taken 10, cut the Navy's fleet from 546 ships to 380, and decreased the number of Air Force squadrons by one-third. Many Clinton cabinet appointees surpassed Grant's or Harding's cabinet in their corruption or outright criminal behavior. Housing and Urban Development, HUD, Secretary Henry Cisneros, was forced to resign after a sexual harassment suit. Associate Attorney General Webster Hubbell was indicted in the Whitewater investigation. Secretary of Agriculture Mike Espy was investigated for illicit connections to Arkansas-based Tyson Foods. And an independent prosecutor examined Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt for illegal dealings with Indian tribes. Virtually all the investigations, in some respect, dealt with money, graft, and bribery, making a mockery of the Clinton campaign promise to appoint the most ethical administration in history. Only the investment banker Robert Rubin, who handled Treasury, seemed remotely suited to the task. And in a shocking break with tradition, Clinton, immediately upon taking office, fired all 93 U.S. attorneys throughout the country, thereby nipping any federal investigations of him in the bud. FBI background checks on White House personnel were also curtailed, apparently for what they might reveal about the appointees. All this only reinforced the suspicion that a number of individuals of questionable character worked in the administration, but it also proved dangerous, facilitating the attendance at White House functions of criminals such as drug runner Jorge Cabrera. Among the other guests at Clinton functions was Wang Ji, an arms dealer who supplied Los Angeles street gangs with automatic weapons, international fugitive Mark Rich, and a steady stream of foreigners whose visits were arranged by John Huang, an indicted Arkansas restaurateur. According to the foreign visitors, they were explicitly told that they could influence the government of the United States by Huang, who himself visited the White House more often than members of Clinton's cabinet. Always, he later testified, to arrange fundraising with foreign nationals. Clinton's disapproval numbers in public polls rose sharply, and surveys showed that people were increasingly convinced the government itself was getting out of hand. For the first time since before the New Deal, Americans started to become concerned about the dark side of programs deemed beneficial by the federal government. This concern was dampened somewhat by a bombing at the World Trade Center in 1993. Islamic extremists detonated a urea nitrate hydrogen bomb in a rental truck in the underground garage of the North Tower. They intended to have it collapse into the second tower, but the structure held. 6 people were killed and more than 1,000 injured. The investigation led to Ramzi Youssef, who was arrested. Despite the obvious conclusion that the United States was being targeted by Islamic extremists, and particularly by a new group known as Al-Qaeda, or the Base, Headed by Saudi Osama bin Laden, the Clinton administration continued to treat terrorism as a law enforcement issue. Sex, Lies, and Monica Lewinsky. Whatever dissatisfaction the public had with government in general, nothing could hide the continued revelations about unethical and illegal activities by Clinton, his wife, or members of the cabinet. In particular, the Clintons' involvement in the bankrupt Whitewater Development Company in Arkansas and its domino effect in bankrupting the Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan forced a three-judge panel in 1994 to name an independent prosecutor, Robert Fisk, to investigate the Clintons' actions. No sooner had Fisk been appointed than the Clinton spin machine, the administration's media managers, initiated a campaign that would typify the Clintons' response to any charges. In 1994, a strategy of demonizing the messenger, which was first used on Fisk, would be finely honed for subsequent and more effective attacks on Fisk's successor, Judge Kenneth Starr. Starr had an impeccable reputation, but he soon found himself under daily attack by Clinton associate James Carvel, who announced he would start his own investigation of Starr. The special prosecutor's job was to investigate conflict of interest charges against the Clintons related to the Whitewater Development Company in Arkansas and promoter James McDougal. McDougal also ran the Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan, which had failed in 1989, but by 1993, evidence had surfaced that Madison funds had gone into Whitewater. Further evidence revealed that the Clintons received preferential treatment in the form of waived fees and had had their share of the down payment in the investments put up by McDougal or others. Billing records with Hillary's name on them surfaced, indicating that she had done substantial work on Whitewater while at the Rose Law Firm, and thus knew exactly where the money had gone, even though she later told a Senate committee that while she had signed the sheets, she had not done the actual work. Yet the more one pulled on the Whitewater string, the more the fabric seemed to unravel. First, there was Travelgate, in which Hillary dismissed the employees of the White House Travel Office, a nonpartisan group, in order to replace them with the travel firm of her friends and high-powered Hollywood producers, Harry and Susan Thomason. Still, there had been no illegality. What turned a presidential preference into an ethical and legal violation was that Mrs. Clinton, to provide a public relations cover for firing so many loyal employees in such a callous fashion, ordered an FBI investigation of Billy Dale, head of the travel office. A mid-level civil servant who had done nothing but hold a job that Hillary had coveted for her friends suddenly found himself having to secure lawyers to defend against charges of corruption. Dale was acquitted of all charges, but he was nearly bankrupted. There were too many improprieties in Travelgate to ignore, and the same three-judge panel that had appointed Starr empowered him to expand his probe into the travel office events. Then, in 1993, Vince Foster, a Rose Law Firm friend of Hillary's who had worked with her at the White House, was found dead at Fort Marcy Park, an apparent suicide. Again, there were enough irregularities in the U.S. Park Police investigation, such as possible movement of the body, that the three-judge panel ordered Starr to add that to his list. By then, as Clinton advisor George Stephanopoulos noted, "We had a team of lawyers nicknamed the Masters of Disaster, whose sole job was to handle Whitewater and related inquiries." Despite the origins of this added tasking of Starr into separate and apparently unrelated cases by the three-judge panel, Starr was 3 for 3 by getting convictions against Webster Hubbell, Susan McDougal, and James McDougal, indicating there was substance to his investigation. However, his attention next turned to a young woman from Arkansas who had reacted to a story about Clinton that had appeared in the American Spectator magazine. In that story, she was named as having been procured for Clinton by Arkansas state troopers. This forced the three-judge panel to put yet another investigation on Starr's plate. While that scenario unfolded, however, dissatisfaction with Clinton's policies, as opposed to allegations of corruption, led to another surprising change. The contract with America. Drawing upon the widespread unease with, and in some cases outright fear about, the growing power and insulation of the federal government from the people who paid the taxes, the Republican Party, under the leadership of Representative Newt Gingrich of Georgia, devised a radical strategy. For essentially 60 years, allowing for two brief interludes in 1946 to 1948 and 1954 to 1956, the Democrats had held the House of Representatives, employing Tip O'Neill's maxim, "All politics is local." Because of Democratic dominance of the House, bills introduced by Republicans to lower taxes, impose term limits, or enact a line-item veto were not even brought up for a vote. This tactic allowed House Democrats to stay off record and to bring home the pork while decrying national budget deficits or to claim to favor measures on which they never had to vote. One cannot emphasize this too much. By avoiding votes on key issues, the Democrats consistently had ducked taking positions that would allow their opponents to unseat them in the next election. Gingrich, sensing that the public was frustrated with the inability to change things in Washington, created a 10-point contract with America, which promised to bring to the House floor for a vote the following 10 measures. 1. A balanced budget law and a line-item veto to enforce it. 2. An anti-crime package. 3. A welfare reform plan. 4. A Family Reinforcement Act designed to increase adoptions and enforce child support laws. 5. An increased Pentagon budget and a prohibition on U.S. troops serving under United Nations control. 6. A product liability legal reform bill and an end to unfunded federal mandates. 7. An increase in the senior citizen Social Security tax limits. 8. A repeal of the marriage tax and a child tax credit. 9. A cut in capital gains taxes. And 10. A term limits bill. Overlaying all of these was an 11th promise, reorganization of the House to ensure greater congressional accountability, which included opening committee meetings to the public, requiring that all laws that apply to the country also apply to Congress, cutting the number of committees and staff by 1/3, and requiring a 3/5 vote to pass any tax increase. The power of the contract, however, was that Gingrich had managed to obtain the support of 300 hopeful Republicans, either in Congress or running for the House, demonstrating a virtual unanimity of purpose. By persuading so many Republicans to stand together on these 10 issues, Gingrich effectively nationalized the local House races and made the 1994 election a national referendum on Bill Clinton's presidency. When the votes were counted in November, the results stunned virtually all political pundits, especially the big-name analysts in the media. For the first time in 40 years, the Republicans had captured both the House and Senate. Wresting the House from the Democrats, Republicans had defeated 35 incumbents, including Tom Foley, the Speaker of the House, befuddling newscasters trying to explain the political shift they had denied would happen. ABC anchor Peter Jennings likened the vote to a temper tantrum by the voters. For a temper tantrum, the voter response was surprisingly consistent and one-sided. In addition to the House and Senate gains, Republicans picked up 11 governorships. Although the media attempted to portray the election as a reaction against incumbents, it was telling that every single Republican incumbent, House, Senate, or State House, won re-election. Only Democrats were thrown out. In the wake of the debacle, still other Democrats in the House and at the local level switched parties in droves, with some 500 joining the Republican Party nationally, the most prominent of whom was the newly elected U.S. Senator from Colorado, Ben Nighthorse Campbell, the first Native American senator. The media, which loved to celebrate diversity, made almost no mention of this fact and never celebrated Campbell's heritage the way it had the ethnicity of blacks and Hispanics. Republicans put in a wide variety of congressmen and women, including former NFL football player Steve Largent, black former Oklahoma University quarterback J.C. Watts, and former rock singer Sonny Bono. A much more significant long-term development accompanied the 1994 election, the rise of the new media that could, like Gingrich, make an end run around the fast-fading traditional press and broadcast television. Spearheaded by Rush Limbaugh's national three-hour radio show in 1988, in which the host analyzed and reported news of the day from a conservative viewpoint, a flood of new talk radio shows revived AM radio virtually overnight, saving the format from extinction. In 1996, talk radio was joined by the conservative Fox News Channel, started by Australian Rupert Murdoch. Equally important as either talk radio or Fox News was the Internet, where Matt Drudge and Andrew Breitbart started the Drudge Report that same year. The Drudge Report, a website with access to posted stories in newsrooms that he ran before the papers or magazines could even get them on the streets, allowed readers to beat the news cycle and read stories before network anchors or editors had a chance to spin or interpret it. Posting hyperlinks to hundreds of articles, often with a blazing siren at the top of the site for shocking, breaking stories, the Drudge Report began to preempt the traditional news cycle and quickly inspired copycats. For the first time, average Americans armed with information from the new media could obtain information on a regular and timely basis that contradicted the official line from the liberal media. This new media was soon joined by outlets from the left, such as the Huffington Post, Salon, and the editorial channel MSNBC, which masquerades as a news channel. Nevertheless, conservative media especially was assailed by the traditional old-line media for being unprofessional and lacking journalistic standards. Of course, what that meant was that the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the three major television networks no longer controlled the news. For the first time ever, they faced competition, and as a result, their subscriptions and viewership began to plunge. Clinton, already in political hot water, crafted a new plan to keep his floundering presidency afloat. He and his advisor, Dick Morris, concocted a strategy called triangulation. He reasoned that he could portray the Republicans and his own party in Congress as obstructionists and claim to serve the greater good. This required a perceived move to the center. Consequently, in his first speech before the Republican-controlled Congress, Clinton said, "The era of big government is over," to wildly enthusiastic applause. House Republicans moved with unusual rapidity. They made good on their contract, bringing up for a vote on the House floor 9 of the 10 items. Only term limits failed to get to the floor, and even that was debated in committee, which had never happened before. Even more surprising, the House passed all 9, and the Senate brought to a floor vote 6 of them. The Supreme Court struck down term limits as unconstitutional before the Senate could act on it, and the line item veto was ruled unconstitutional after Clinton had signed it into law. Among the legislation that passed both houses, a welfare reform bill dramatically curtailed aid to families with dependent children, AFDC programs, to the howls of protest from liberal groups who prophesied that millions would be put on the streets. In fact, by the mid-1990s, welfare benefits at the state levels in New England had a generosity that rivaled that of socialist Sweden. Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Washington, D.C., and Rhode Island all had an after-tax value of welfare benefits, including food stamps, AFDC, public housing, Medicaid, and other subsidized services that exceeded a $12 per hour job. New York City's rates had reached the astronomical level of $30,700 per year, or more than the starting salary of a computer scientist or secretary. Clinton promptly vetoed the bill, whereupon the House passed it a second time. Clinton vetoed it a second time before polling information told him that, in fact, the bill was quite popular. Finally, after at last signing welfare reform, Clinton claimed credit for it. In the end, Clinton signed three of the contract items, welfare reform, unfunded federal mandates, and a line item veto, and Congress overrode his veto of the Stockholder Bill of Rights. For the business-as-usual crowd in Washington, it was a stunning display of promises kept. 40% of the items that the GOP had promised only to bring to the floor for discussion actually became law. Clinton's own polling and focus group data confirmed he had to sign these pieces of legislation to maintain his triangulation. House conservatives mistook their stunning but narrow election as an overwhelming mandate for change. Instead of taking small steps, then returning to the voters to ask their validation, Republicans advanced on a number of fronts, including launching investigations of Whitewater and conducting an emotional hearing on the Waco, Texas disaster in April 1993. At Waco, a sect of the Seventh-day Adventists' church, the Branch Davidians under David Koresh, had holed up in a compound after agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, BATF, botched a raid based on scanty evidence and unsubstantiated claims of child abuse. Ignoring several opportunities to arrest Koresh outside the compound and avoid a firefight, the agents, bolstered by the Texas Rangers and National Guard troops, attacked, firing gas grenades inside the buildings. Fires broke out instantly, killing 82 men, women, and children. Questions as to how the fires started implicated both the Davidians and the government. Clinton claimed to have no knowledge of the operation, passing the buck to his Attorney General, Janet Reno, who in turn did not take action against any of the FBI agents involved in improper and possibly illegal acts. Civil rights activists were outraged, and the GOP Congress, already concerned about the growing abuse of power by the IRS, BATF, and FBI, listened to witnesses from inside the compound describe attacks by a government tank that had smashed down the compound's walls, and sharpshooters who had peppered the Davidian complex. Democrats, desperate to protect Clinton and Reno from any political fallout, muddied the waters sufficiently so that no government agents were charged. These and other abuses of federal power put Clinton on the defensive, and despite triangulation, his poll numbers began again to fall. Then an explosion in Oklahoma City halted the congressional momentum, while at the same time presenting Clinton with a golden opportunity to generate sympathy for the federal government. A disaffected and mentally unstable Gulf War veteran, Timothy McVeigh, and at least one accomplice, Terry Nichols, planned, positioned, and detonated a massive bomb outside the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City on April 19, 1995. The blast killed 169 men, women, and children. There was a daycare facility in the building, and constituted the worst terrorist attack up to that point in American history. President Clinton traveled to Oklahoma City and, according to one of his worst journalistic enemies, handled the ceremony with consummate skill. He also took the opportunity in a national address to blame conservative talk radio for an atmosphere of hate that had produced Tim McVeigh. The president used the disaster to shift public attention from the abusive actions of government to the crazed behavior of the bomber and the American militia movement, which had steadily gained members prior to April 1995. McVeigh later admitted responsibility for the bombing and placed himself fully in the anti-government movement, claiming that he was seeking retribution for the devastation at Waco 2 years earlier. He had even attempted to time the explosion to coincide with the anniversary of the assault on the Branch Davidians. In the wake of Oklahoma City, Clinton's ratings rose to 51%, and he never really saw his popularity diminish again. But in his haste to lay the blame on anti-government extremists, Clinton and the entire U.S. intelligence community missed several troubling clues and perhaps focused on domestic threats, not foreign terrorists. Neither Waco nor the Oklahoma City bombings seemed to affect the recovering economy or the booming stock market. Clinton owed much of his renewed approval ratings to the 1990s boom. But could he claim credit for it? Riding Reagan's coattails, the Roaring '90s. Having run against the worst economy in the last 50 years and having ridden into office by reminding themselves and George Bush, "It's the economy, stupid," the Clinton team knew that, in fact, the industrial and technological growth that had occurred since 1993 was in no small way the result of the Reagan policies they publicly derided. Despite tax hikes under Bush and Clinton, the incentives created in the Reagan years continued to generate jobs and growth. Clinton had one pro-growth policy, the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, which would lower tariffs between the United States and its two major continental trading partners, Canada and Mexico. But it ran into stiff opposition from Clinton's own party in Congress. Environmentalists, labor unions, and protectionists all lobbied against the bill, and Citizen Perot led the anti-NAFTA crusade to television, where he faced Vice President Gore on CNN in a debate over the plan. In Congress, however, the bill was saved only when a large percentage of Republicans in the House voted for it, whereas the Democrats voted in large numbers against it. NAFTA proceeded over the next several years to add large numbers of jobs to the U.S. economy, contrary to the dire predictions of its opponents. More important to the financial markets, after the Republicans gained control of Congress, the message was that, indeed, the era of big government was over. Or so it seemed. At any rate, the financial markets reacted. Although Wall Street had crept upward from 1992 to 1994, the Dow Jones flew into the stratosphere, climbing further and faster than the market had at any time since the Great Depression. Individual retirement accounts, IRAs, swelled in value as yuppies, or young urban professionals, entered the stock market in growing numbers through their retirement plans. More Americans than ever held securities and paid attention to the markets, not as speculators, but as investors in their retirements and college tuition for their children. Already on the defensive after the Oklahoma City bombing, Republicans nevertheless thought they could rebound by refocusing on the 1995 budget. Gingrich hoped to impose an austere but reasonable spending plan on Clinton, unaware that the president had already determined to use the budget impasse to close all non-essential government services and blame it on the Republicans. Documents later leaked out showing that in the summer, several months before the shutdown occurred, Clinton administration officials had met with leaders of the federal employee unions to ensure that they would side with the White House. When the GOP submitted its plan, Clinton refused to sign the bills and allowed all non-essential government services, parks, libraries, citizen assistance bureaus, museums, and all non-critical offices to shut down. The media cooperated fully, having already characterized Gingrich as Dr. Seuss's Grinch with the headline, "The Gingrich Who Stole Christmas," portraying the shutdown as a disaster despite the fact that defense, the IRS, and other essential federal offices continued to work. Television talk shows featured laid-off park rangers or private sector entrepreneurs who supplied the government with goods, all of whom suddenly had no income. At the end of a few weeks, the media had convinced the public that the Republicans were to blame. The shell-shocked congressional Republicans did not recover their confidence for years. Portrayals of the Republican House members set new low marks for distortion, deception, and fear-mongering in American politics. But it was effective. After 1995, many Republicans drifted to a more moderate position to avoid incurring the wrath of the Washington Press Corps. Still, Clinton's own polling told him the issue of fiscal responsibility that the GOP had advocated was warmly received in the heartland, and he could not ignore it. Clinton spoke with greater frequency about balancing the budget, a phrase uttered mostly by Republicans in the previous 60 years. He admitted that the robust economy had generated such tax revenues that with a modicum of fiscal restraint, the United States could balance the budget in 10 years, or in 7 years, or even sooner. Such talk only further accelerated the markets. By the time Clinton left office, the Dow had broken the 11,000 mark, and although it was already in retreat in Clinton's last 6 months, it produced consistent federal budget surpluses. Yet it would not be completely accurate to ascribe the exceptional economic growth of the 1990s entirely to the tax cuts of the 1980s, to the elections of 1994, or to Clinton's support of NAFTA. Powerful economic forces coalesced to contribute to the creation of such fantastic wealth. Computer chip prices had plummeted at an annual rate of 68% since the 1980s, to the extent that by the year 2000, the price of a bit is close to a millionth of a cent as the billion transistor device, the gigachip, is introduced. A single production line could fabricate 1.6 trillion transistors in 24 hours, and in 1999 alone, 50,000 trillion transistors were produced, providing such a surplus that Americans used them to play solitaire or to keep the interior temperature of Cadillacs at 65 degrees. Equally impressive, in 1999, internet traffic and bandwidth doubled every 3 months, traveling over fiber cable that carried 8.6 petabits per second per fiber sheath, or a number equal to the entire internet traffic per month carried in 1995. Indeed, the computer had spread more rapidly to one quarter of the population than any other technology in American history except the cellular phone, 16 years compared to 13. That remarkable democratization of technology would quickly be eclipsed by yet another computer-related product, the internet, which spread to a quarter of the population in merely 7 years. Naturally, such stunning increases in productivity caused the value of tech companies to soar. Qualcomm, a company few people had even heard of prior to 1999, saw its shares rise in value by 2,619% in less than 2 years. Brokerage and finance firms grew so fast that they defied traditional accounting and measurement tools. Employment only doubled in the brokerage business between 1973 to 1987, yet the number of shares traded daily exploded from 5.7 million to 63.8 million. Although the Bureau of Labor Statistics recorded a 50% drop in productivity costs of computers from 1992 to 1994, in fact, the costs had fallen at a rate closer to 40% per year. And those price declines only accelerated. Astonishingly, Clinton actually sought to interfere with this growth. In 1993, the Clinton Justice Department initiated a campaign against the nation's largest operating systems company, Bill Gates's Microsoft, for allegedly bundling its internet browser with its Windows operating system. In May 1998, the department's antitrust division filed suit against Microsoft. 19 states, seeing a new gravy train alongside tobacco litigation, joined the suit. The Justice Department contended that the bundling required consumers to buy both products and gave Microsoft an unfair advantage over Netscape and other rival companies. Yet Netscape was the industry leader, and there was no evidence that Microsoft met any of the traditional criteria that defined restraint of trade. For example, Microsoft's prices on its products were falling, and its service was good. There was no barriers to entry into the browser market. Indeed, Netscape dominated that market. But Americans seldom get worked up when the wealthy are targeted by government, and although consumer surveys showed that upward of 90% of Microsoft customers applauded the company, competitors were visceral in their anger toward Gates, who many claimed had stolen others' ideas. Whereas monopoly theory posits that competitors should benefit from litigation against a monopolist, exactly the opposite happened with Microsoft. Every time the government advanced in the case, the stocks of virtually all of the computer companies, especially Microsoft's main competitors, fell. Each time Microsoft gained ground, the share values of all Microsoft's competitors rose. Thus, while the federal and state governments engaged in an attack on a major American business in the name of promoting competition, in reality, the market judged that the Microsoft suit was damaging the entire computer industry. An ominous reaction occurred in the wake of the Microsoft antitrust announcement when markets slowed, then, as the case drew to a conclusion, turned downward. By that time, some analysts had lumped these businesses into a catch-all phrase called the new economy, which included medical, optics, fiber, aviation, computers, software, telecommunications, and any other field that they could fit into the digital revolution. Computers produced remarkable increases in virtually all related fields and started to pull away from the otherwise impressive gains made in low-tech industries, at least until the year 2000. A second contributing factor to the business boom of the 90s was the opening of markets in the former Soviet bloc. As Eastern European countries, for the first time since 1939, engaged in free trade with the West, the resulting flow of goods and services eastward resembled the American entrance into Western Europe at the end of World War II. U.S. entrepreneurs, oil experts, bankers, computer geeks, and academic consultants poured into Hungary, Romania, Poland, Ukraine, Russia, and the Baltic republics. American overseas trade to those areas grew accordingly. Still another part of the economic equation, low energy prices, played a role in sustaining the boom. The Gulf War had secured Middle Eastern oil at low prices, and although American oil companies, drillers, and refiners operated on thin profit margins, the cheap energy costs spilled over into almost every sector of the economy. Any products made with petroleum became cheaper to make. Everything that was shipped by rail, truck, or aircraft was cheaper to transport. And the portion of manufacturing cost dedicated to energy plummeted. Even if goods did not seem cheaper on the rack or at the store, corporations reallocated resources within their firms toward research and development, turning out new products and adding value. That did not guarantee that the rich got richer, especially when it came to businesses, where only 34 of the top 100 firms in the Wall Street Journal in 1990 were still on the list in 1999. This trend was confirmed in the international arena, where, again, American companies were heavily represented. There was a 25% turnover among the top 100 multinational firms from 1990 to 1997. At the same time, the share of total corporate assets held by the top 500 industrial firms fell by 20%, and the employment by those same firms fell 29%. The share of gross domestic product generated by those firms plummeted 39% in 13 years. With the economy growing, the expansion showed two clear trends. First, the growth came from small companies and new entrepreneurs. And second, there was tremendous turnover at the top, indicating extremely high levels of competition. Both trends were highly favorable for a vibrant economy. Throughout the Bush and Clinton presidencies, Alan Greenspan, a disciple of free market economist Friedrich Hayek and an avid reader of Ayn Rand, had served as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Greenspan had lived through the Ford-Carter inflationary years and had watched with concern the rise of federal deficits in the 1980s. Despite his free market training, Greenspan's Fed seemed locked into a permanent anti-inflation mode. Any good news in the economy, rising industrial production, higher employment figures, better trade numbers, might cause prices to go up, which would appear on Greenspan's radar detector as a threat. The chairman found himself raising the prime rate repeatedly, trying to slow down the stock market. It was a perverse situation, to say the least. The most powerful banker in America constantly slapping the nation's wage earners and entrepreneurs for their success. Worse, Greenspan's actions resulted in a constant underfunding of business, and the nation suffered from a slow-acting capital anemia. Home prices continued to rise, though not at levels seen in the 1970s. As Americans invested in both homes and the stock market, wealth levels grew as never before. The 1990s saw more millionaires made than at any other time in American history, and at the same time, the wealth gap between the top 20% and the bottom 20% grew. Some of this was to be expected. In any growing, thriving economy, that gap should expand as rapid leaps of innovation and invention make entrepreneurs rich overnight. There was some disconcerting evidence, however, that the 1990s, much more so than the 1980s, was a decade of greed. For example, American family debt levels soared faster than ever, and the ratio of debt to equity in family homes rose steadily. A robust economy also provided Clinton with one of his main selling points, a claim to have provided budget surpluses resulting from his economic policies. In fact, Clinton and Congress could enjoy and spend the fruits of a roaring economy provided by Reagan's policies and numerous other factors over which they had no control at all. Indeed, no genuine surpluses existed if one included the Medicare and Social Security trust funds that had long ago been folded into general revenues. But the balanced budgets helped insulate Clinton from attacks on his ethics and character, providing him with the critical flak jacket he needed late in the decade. Prosperity, undergirded by liberty, continued to act as a magnet to draw people from all over the world to America's shores. Increasingly, Asian and Indian engineers populated the engineering departments of major American universities. West Indian and Jamaican immigrants carved out thriving restaurant and grocery businesses in Atlantic seaboard cities. And former boat people from Vietnam populated the fishing fleet on the Gulf Coast. The success of immigrants changed the look of America, and in the 2000 census, individual Americans for the first time could mark their descent from more than one race, creating some 57 new categories of ethnicities. As early as 1990, the fastest growing racial category on a census form was other, in part representing a genuine feeling that people saw themselves as multi-ethnic, but also reflecting the position that one's race was only one of many determinants of self-identity. Already, multiracial groups composed 8% of Hawaii's population and 10% of Oklahoma's. More Americans than ever before encountered people of all races, ethnic identities, and faiths in their daily routine, so certainly animosities were not the result of unfamiliarity. Rather, programs such as affirmative action had placed, in many cases, disproportionate numbers of blacks and Hispanics in a wide variety of occupations, government service, and in higher education, although the same laws tended to exclude Asians and Jews. In 2004, Robert Putnam, a professor of public policy who studied the nature and, in his view, collapse of American communities, found that the more racially and ethnically mixed communities were, the less trust existed. These groups actually had lower levels of community consciousness than more homogeneous neighborhoods. In many cases, socioeconomic and cultural differences reduced trust. People simply did not think they could trust others who did not share their values. Thus, as the year 2000 neared, racial harmony remained the dream Martin Luther King had had some 30 years before. On the one hand, the realization of that dream in practical terms was closer than ever because millions of black families had entered the middle class, become stockholders and business owners, professionals and labor leaders, executives and stars. Yet racial divides appeared quickly, as in the O.J. Simpson murder case in the early 1990s. Nevertheless, overall American race relations at the end of the 1990s remained better than anywhere else in the world, as horrible race riots in England and Muslim gang attacks on native French citizens there would later attest. Social pathologies, spiritual renewal. Unlike the 1960s, when street crime led to surging gun ownership, in the 1990s it was renewed distrust of government that had sparked a rise in gun sales and concealed carry laws. In the wake of the McVeigh bombing, gun control groups pressed for the Brady Bill, legislation named after President Reagan's press secretary, Jim Brady, who had been wounded in the 1981 assassination attempt and which had been advocated by his wife, Sarah. The Brady Bill required registration by gun purchasers and a waiting period before acquiring a gun, ostensibly to reduce gun crimes. Gun owners feared this was the first step in a national confiscation, as had occurred in the Weimar Republic in the 1920s, leaving the public defenseless against a tyrannical government. There was one small detail that gun control groups ignored. Gun crimes, according to both federal and state authorities, peaked in Bush's term, roughly 2 years before the Brady Bill kicked in. Under Reagan and Bush, prosecutions of federal gun violations had risen from 2,500 to about 9,500 in 1992. This was remarkable because the call for new gun laws came on the heels of 2 years of non-prosecution of existing gun laws by the Clinton administration. It allowed Clinton to set up a self-fulfilling cycle. There were more gun crimes, therefore the nation needed more gun laws. The Brady Act was passed in February 1994, followed by the Clinton-Gore semi-automatic ban later that year. Yet gun prosecutions at the federal level continued to fall sharply, back to where the number had stood when Bush took office. It allowed Clinton, in the wake of several highly publicized gun crimes, including the Columbine High School shooting in April 1999, to paint gun owners as irresponsible at a time when his administration failed to enforce the existing gun laws. In fact, momentum swung toward less gun regulation, Several states began to pass concealed carry laws that tended to further reduce crime. Through a crime crackdown under Republican Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, New York City homicides per 100,000 were lower than in the 1800s. Issues of gun ownership reached a key point in 2001 when the Emerson case in Texas came before a federal district court. It represented the first time since the Great Depression's original gun control laws had taken effect that the meaning of the Second Amendment was actually addressed in a higher court. The court ruled that, in fact, the right to bear arms was an individual right, not a militia right, and therefore meant exactly what proponents of the amendment for years had said it did. Although the justices attempted to include language that might still allow state and local gun regulation, the critical issue of whether the militia referred to the National Guard units or to armed individuals was settled in favor of individuals. In 2008, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, reaffirmed that the Second Amendment applied to individual rights, even in federal enclaves such as the District of Columbia. Issues of gun control divided the public almost as sharply as the abortion issue. Each, in turn, was closely associated with particular religious viewpoints. A growing number of Americans seemed concerned about family values and social maladies, including abortion, drugs, illegitimacy, and street crime, which were broadly linked to a decline in the spiritual side of American life. The nation, by the 1990s, had slowly but steadily moved toward attitudes more favorable to religion and generally, though not universally, expressed at the polls concerns against normalizing what were once considered objectionable or even deviant lifestyles. In early 2001, the Pew Charitable Trusts concluded a broad study of the role of religion in public life and found Americans strongly equate religion with personal ethics and behavior, considering it an antidote to the moral decline they perceive in our nation today. This was accompanied by an equally strong respect for religious diversity and tolerance of other people's beliefs. Nearly 70% disagreed with the statement that the nation would do well even if many Americans were to abandon their religious faith. And a similar percentage wanted religion's influence on American society to grow, whereas only 6% wanted it to weaken. Nearly 80% supported either a moment of silence or a specific prayer in public schools. And at a ratio of 2-1, the respondents agreed that prayer taught children that religion and God were important. 2/3 of the respondents were not threatened by more religious leaders becoming involved in politics. Majorities of Americans sensed a bias among journalists against Christians, and 68% agreed that there was a lot of prejudice in the media toward evangelical Christians. The spiritual renewal had started perhaps as early as the 1980s, when a Gallup survey found that 80% of Americans believed in a final judgment before God. 90% claimed to pray, and 84% said Jesus was God or the Son of God. Most of the growth that had occurred in American Christianity came from one of two sources. First, Hispanic immigrants who tended to be Catholics brought renewed energy to the Roman Catholic Church, which, with 60 million members, was the largest denomination in the United States. Second, independent, non-denominational churches grew at astronomical rates. The largest churches in America, that is, a group of similarly minded believers at a single location, included Willow Creek, 20,000 members in Chicago, Crenshaw Christian Center, 22,000 members in Los Angeles, and Southeast Christian Church in Louisville, 17,000 members. Focused on soul winning through modern methods, contemporary music, abundant church athletic and musical activities, large youth programs, These churches kept two groups who had abandoned the mainstream churches years earlier, males and young people. On average, the new believers tended to be quite well-educated. 29% of adults who described themselves as evangelical had a college degree, higher than the U.S. average, and wealthier than in the past. While the share of adult born-again Christians in households making more than $60,000 almost doubled from 1991 to 2000. The newer churches had tapped into the call for men to be family heads, and assisted by such independent programs as Promise Keepers, they emphasized strong traditional families with a male family leader. At the same time, the use of contemporary music, innovative teaching methods, and teen-oriented Bible messages brought millions of American youths to Christianity. By 1991, a survey showed that 86% of teens said they believed Jesus Christ is God or the Son of God, and 73% considered regular church attendance an important aspect of American citizenship. An even more surprising, perhaps, statistic showed that nearly one-third accepted the Bible as the literal Word of God. Despite what people told pollsters, however, there were signs that this revival was already losing steam, or at the very least, transforming into something quite different. George Barna, whose organization routinely researched religious matters, discovered that 80% of believers admitted they did not think they entered into the presence of God at church, that most believers very rarely witnessed to others, and fewer than 10% gave the biblical tithe of 10% to their church, even though one-third claimed to do so. At the same time, most of those evangelicals expressed a profound longing for drawing closer to the Christian God, leaving Barna and subsequent writers who have studied the decline in church membership to conclude that a growing house church movement had taken root. Ever attuned to image and style, Clinton, early in his presidency, had suddenly begun attending church regularly. But Clinton best employed religion during the impeachment scandal, when he brought in several spiritual advisors, such as the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who at the time was secretly conducting his own extramarital affair, to help him deal with his mistakes. In fact, the spiritual renewal that had begun percolating through the United States had not quite come to a boil by 1996, when Clinton campaigned for re-election, or even by 1998, when he was impeached. But the general sense of moral unease with the president's actions certainly came into focus after 1999. I did not have sex with that woman. The buoyant economy was a tremendous firewall for Clinton against any Republican challenger in 1996. It was ironic that, having come into office criticizing the Reagan policies, Clinton now claimed credit for them and fortified his re-election bid with them. Perhaps aware that any candidate would be a sacrificial lamb, the Mondale of 1996, the Republicans nominated warhorse Robert Dole of Kansas, who had walked point for Gerald Ford in 1976. Dole had paid his dues, and minor challenges from other candidates had failed to gain traction. Already the question before the electorate was clear. Would any candidate running on character issues be sufficient to unseat a president in a booming economy in peacetime? Ross Perot returned with another independent campaign as the nominee of the Reform Party. However, in 1996, the issues differed dramatically from those of 1992. Budget deficits were gone or disappearing, unemployment had plummeted, and free trade no longer seemed a threat. Perot severely hurt himself by failing to attack Clinton's credibility and character problems, leaving Dole as the only real alternative to Clinton. Dole lacked Reagan's charm and grace, and though not without humor, Dole later appeared in clever Pepsi, Visa, and Viagra commercials, the GOP standard-bearer seemed too old. He was younger than Reagan at 73, but seemed to lack energy. His vice presidential nominee, tax-cutting advocate and former Buffalo Bills quarterback Jack Kemp, lacked the aggressiveness to attack weaknesses in the Democratic platform. Above all, Dole and Kemp still operated out of fear that lingered from the 1995 government shutdown when the Democrats had successfully demonized Republicans as opposing children and the elderly. Clinton's vulnerability lay in the serious character weaknesses. The lies about extramarital affairs had already become well documented. Equally important, the Democratic National Committee had developed a strategy for burying the Republicans under a tidal wave of cash from any source. Clinton rode the crest of that wave. Slowly at first, then with greater frequency, reports of Clinton's unethical and often illegal fundraising activities began to appear in the press. Concern about money from the Communist People's Republic of China, funneled through John Huang into the Clinton-Gore coffers, percolated through newsrooms. But the media never closed the loop of equating the cash with policy payoffs by the administration. With the Clinton media team in full spin mode, each new revelation was carefully managed by several loyalists who received talking points by fax machines each morning. They were immediately dispatched to the television talk shows to claim that, 1, everybody does it, 2, there was really nothing illegal about the transactions, and 3, the allegations were merely Republican efforts to smear Clinton. Without a tenacious press to look skeptically at every administration defense and defender, as it had in the Watergate era, Clinton successfully swept aside the most damaging issues of the campaign. When the votes were tallied in November, Clinton still had not cracked the 50% mark, netting 49%, whereas Dole received 41% and Perot snatched 8%. Clinton increased his electoral margin over 1992 by only 9 electoral votes, indicating the damage done to him by the ongoing scandals. Even after his re-election, the character issue haunted Clinton in the form of an ongoing thorn in his side named Paula Corbin Jones. Named in the American Spectator Troopergate story as having had an affair with then-Governor Clinton, Jones set out to prove that something quite different had happened. In 1994, Jones filed a civil lawsuit against President Clinton for sexual harassment during a political event at a Little Rock hotel while Clinton was governor of Arkansas. While working a meeting at the Excelsior Hotel in 1991, Clinton sent troopers to ask her to come up to a hotel room to meet the governor. And Jones claimed that once she had entered the room and realized that only she and Clinton were there, Governor Clinton exposed himself and asked her to perform oral sex on him. Jones refused, left the room, then alleged she had suffered various job detriments for refusing his advances. The lawsuit proved historic because in 1997, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against Clinton's legal claim that a citizen could not sue a president. Quite the contrary, the Supreme Court unanimously concluded, like every other citizen who properly invokes the district court's jurisdiction, she has a right to an orderly disposition of her claims. Or, stated another way, no citizen is above the law. Jones's legal team began the discovery process, during which it gathered evidence and took depositions. Understandably, one of the questions the Jones legal team asked Clinton in his deposition required him to identify all the women with whom he had had sexual relations since 1986. He was married the entire time. Clinton answered under oath, "None." Already, Jennifer Flowers and former Miss Arkansas Sally Perdue had claimed to have had an affair with Clinton. Flowers' affair occurred during the time in question. But the Jones team found several others. One of them was Juanita Broderick, who contended that in April 1978, Clinton had raped her while he was Attorney General of Arkansas, and while she had told a co-worker at the time, she had not pressed charges. In fact, one relationship was still going on at the time of Jones's suit. Regular sexual liaisons at the White House between Clinton and a young intern, Monica Lewinsky. Most Clinton biographers disagree over whether Hillary knew about the liaisons and still protected her husband to hang on to power, or whether she was kept in the dark. The fact that the President of the United States would boldly lie about his relationship with Lewinsky to representatives of a federal court would have gone unreported, except for the work of an internet sleuth, Matt Drudge's Drudge Report, which learned that Newsweek magazine had found out about the Lewinsky affair, but had determined to spike the story. Drudge ran with it, forcing the major media outlets to cover it and, in the process, establishing himself as the vanguard of a new wave of internet reporters. The Clinton-Lewinsky case, therefore, became as significant for the change it heralded in journalism as it had done for the actual facts of the case. Already, Rush Limbaugh had exposed the details of the Clinton healthcare plan on AM radio. Now an unknown internet reporter had broken a case that the major partisan press refused to uncover. Meanwhile, a wave of indignation spread about the president's involvement with a young intern. Clinton concluded that he could not tell the public the truth because it would destroy him politically. In a televised appearance, he blatantly lied to the nation. "I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Ms. Lewinsky." It harkened back to Nixon's famous statement to the American people that their president was not a crook. Clinton's team revived the successful nuts and sluts strategy that had worked well in the early 1990s with Jennifer Flowers, painting Lewinsky, Jones, and Perdue as crazy or promiscuous. Yet no sooner had the first blast of public scorn receded when another woman, a supporter of the president's named Kathleen Willey, appeared on a national television news show to claim that Clinton had harassed her too, pinning her against a wall while he groped her in the White House. Starr's investigation now had to shift gears. Independent counsels are charged with the task of investigating all episodes of obstruction of justice, including any new charges that arise during the original investigation. That, after all, was exactly what had sunk Nixon: investigations of subsequent infractions, not the burglary. The new allegations required Starr to investigate the Jones claims as well, and he was ordered to do so by the three-judge panel that had handed him the Foster and Travelgate cases. Starr's investigation